Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, April the 1st, these are our main stories. Gaza's Shifa Hospital is left in ruins as Israel pulls back from a two-week military operation. Turkey's opposition wins big in local elections on a night of heavy defeats for the party of President Erdogan. And 12 people are arrested in Pakistan over a car bombing of Chinese workers involved in a hydroelectric dam project. Also in this podcast, the first green shoots of growth appear in the world's second biggest economy, the fight to save Africa's marine wildlife from a tsunami of plastic waste, and
it is a spirit. And that spirit is unvanquished. It does not disappear. It does not become depressed because of all this. Look at how cheerful people are.
Hundreds of people turn out to mark the closure of an independent bookstore in Hong Kong after constant complaints from the authorities. Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, has taken in some of the many thousands of Palestinians who suffered from Israel's military operation in the territory. But the medical facility has itself borne the brunt of some of the most recent intense military bombardment. Now, Israel says it has completed its operation there and all its troops have left the area. The UN's Georgios Petropoulos, who's in Gaza, told the BBC that all sides should respect the status of Al-Shifa and other hospitals.
The international humanitarian law tells us that if a hospital is functioning as a hospital, is at a protected place. We continue to call on all parties. You have to let these hospitals be hospitals. If any side is using it as anything other than that, it stands to lose its legitimate status as a protected site. We don't have enough of these things left here in the Gaza Strip to be playing games like this.
I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yoland Nell, why the Israelis had pulled out.
They say that their operation there has been completed, and you can now see video on social media that shows this Al-Shifa site basically burnt out with parts of it in total ruins. A lot of destruction in the area around, which is a residential area, and the Hamas-run health ministry says dozens of bodies have been found at that site. Now, witnesses said that there had been Israeli airstrikes, that there was shelling in that area this morning at the time when tanks and armoured vehicles withdrew, apparently giving them cover. And we can see now that crowds of Palestinians have returned to the site, are looking around sort of bewildered. And the Israeli Prime Minister had said when he spoke just last night that this had become Al-Shifa a terrorist lair, in his words, although Hamas has consistently denied using hospitals in Gaza as a base. The Israeli military said that there were some 200 terrorists, in its words, killed in and around the Shifa site in the last 2 weeks, calling this previously one of the most successful operations of the war so far. Palestinians who live in that area told us that there were many innocent people who had been killed. They had been left starving. They'd been left without water. Hamas said that there were doctors and there were patients that were killed during this operation.
As you say, the place is in ruins. Can it ever really function as a hospital again?
I mean, I think it will have to be totally rebuilt. Interestingly, the hospital had started to go back into service not long after the previous raid back in November by the Israeli military. But now we can see that there was so much close quarters fighting that took place. There were airstrikes in and around the hospital that it has left it with extremely sort of serious damage, I think. Parts will just have to be raised in order for it to function as a hospital again.
We've also been getting these reports that Israel has arrested the sister of the leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, and she was living in Israel.
That's correct. I mean, this is something that we were just hearing about, that she was a resident of a town in the south of Israel called Tel Sheva, and that she's been arrested on suspicion of contact with operatives from Hamas and on suspicion of supporting acts of terror. She's said to be a 57-year-old woman arrested in a joint operation with the Israeli Domestic Intelligence Services. Her name hasn't been given out, but we understand that she's supposed to appear at the Beersheba Magistrates Court later for a hearing on her detention. We have heard previously about Ismail Haniyeh's relatives during the course of the war. It was said that one of his granddaughters, still in Gaza, where he's from, was killed in an Israeli airstrike. Of course, you know, Ismail Haniyeh has lived for some years now out of Gaza. He's usually based in Qatar.
Yoland Nell. Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in excellent health following surgery to treat a hernia, according to the hospital that's been treating him. Mr. Netanyahu's medical condition hasn't stifled criticism of his handling of the war with Hamas and his failure thus far to achieve the release of those Israelis still held in Gaza. Tens of thousands of protesters have filled the streets of big cities across Israel, calling for Mr. Netanyahu's resignation and urging him to call fresh elections and strike an immediate deal to free the remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza. They gathered outside the Israeli parliament, from where our international editor Jeremy Bowen reports.
We are just outside the Knesset. The Israelis have already deployed hundreds of police officers, and Katia, demonstrator, opponent of the government, is here with her loudhailer.
Since 8 this morning I'm here, and now I'm telling Bibi Netanyahu that I'll be glad to pay one-way ticket first class for him to go out and not come back.
Will they listen to you?
No, they don't listen to us. We are not important for them.
Inside the Knesset, Israel's parliament, the Netanyahu coalition depends on the support of ultra-nationalist Jewish MPs.
Good afternoon, sir. Jeremy Bowen.
Like the Prime Minister, Ohad Tal, one of his backers from the Religious Zionism Party, believes only military force in Gaza will free the hostages, not trusting Hamas to respect a deal.
It's a very naive thing to say, because you don't think Hamas will bring back so easily the hostages in a deal, release everybody, and then will allow us to, you know, kill all the terrorists that we will release in such a deal in the day after. It's not as simple.
Well, it's mid-evening now, and I'm back near the Knesset, and there are thousands of demonstrators, probably tens of thousands, in the broad avenue outside it, where the government ministries are, including the Prime Minister's office. Now, I've been talking to a very senior former general, prominent politician, didn't want to be interviewed. He wants elections here, and all these people want elections as well. And the general just said to me, he said, look, this is going to make a difference. I'm not so sure about that. Mr. Netanyahu's been on TV. He says they're not having elections.
Calls for elections will paralyze Israel. They will paralyze negotiations for the release of our hostages and will lead to ending the war before achieving its goals.
I've come behind the main platform now, the place where they're making speeches, to the area where the leaders of this protest are. Benjamin Netanyahu, when he first became prime minister in 1996, his office was run by David Agmon, a brigadier general, and he's here tonight, one of the protest leaders. How serious is this crisis for Israel?
It's the biggest crisis ever. I was the first chief of staff of Netanyahu in 96. And after 3 months, I decided to leave because I found that he is a danger to Israel.
Why?
Because he doesn't know how to take decisions, and I saw his lies. And after 3 months, I told him, Bibi, you don't need aid, you need a replacement.
After the 7th of October attacks, Israelis were so shocked and traumatized by what happened. They put aside their divisions for a while, but they are wide open once again, 6 months in. And there are two big points. One is getting the hostages back, because that hasn't happened. And the other one is the future of the Prime Minister. And certainly on this street today, this very big demonstration, they want him out.
Jeremy Bowen in Jerusalem. For months, years even, the news out of the Chinese economy has not been good. Low growth, rising unemployment and a crisis in the property sector. But now, official figures suggest that the world's second largest economy is showing tentative signs of recovery. The National Statistics Bureau says factory output is slightly up for the first time in 6 months. With the details, here's our Asia business reporter Nick Marsh.
Factory output is used in China as a measure of its economic health because it's, you know, such a big manufacturing powerhouse. And if you've been following what's been going on in China the last sort of year or two, they're going through quite a bad economic slowdown. Maybe the worst economic slowdown it's had in modern times, actually. You know, we're used to hearing all this stuff about China being this, you know, behemoth, really, this, you know, world's second largest economy, an engine for global growth. But recently you've had this awful crisis in the property sector, youth unemployment's high, growth's been really low by its own very high standards. And this news from its manufacturing output, its factory activity, is actually indicating that it's up, which shows that there could be some kind of, you know, green shoots of recovery situation after all this bad news. It's rare positive news. So, you know, the government will be happy about that, but there is still a long way to go, you know, because the problems, they run deep. It's an economy built on making things, building things. If you run out of things to build, or if you build too much, like they have with houses, the big property crisis, you get these bubbles. So, you know, it's about transitioning out of it. But a small short-term piece of good news for people in China right now.
Nick Marsh. Discarded plastic in the world's oceans kills countless sea mammals every year, trapping and entangling them. On Africa's southwest coast, the environmental group Ocean Conservation Namibia says it has rescued around 3,000 seals since 2020. The team uses large nets to close in and capture seals entangled in discarded fishing gear and other maritime rubbish. Katja Dreyer is the co-founder of Ocean Conservation Namibia. She's been telling Joe Inwood about their work and the scale of the problem.
Most of our seal rescues are fairly easy. We just catch the animal, cut through the entanglement, and release the animal. And it often just takes a couple of seconds. Other rescues take very long because the entanglement is deeply embedded in the wound, in the flesh. And then we always need to find a balance between working as quick as possible to get the entanglement off and also try to avoid more damage and pain to the animal. We celebrate every single rescued animal as a huge accomplishment for our team. And it's always a really joyous moment, but also at the same time, just considering the amount of disentanglements we've done over the past years, we're always painfully aware that we're only treating a symptom to the problem and not the actual root cause.
Yeah, because tell people who don't understand this how big a problem rubbish and especially plastic discarded fishing nets, how big a problem is this?
It's a massive problem. I mean, one of the biggest issues is probably that we don't get to see it. Once the plastic is in the ocean, it's below the surface and nobody cares about it anymore. But for our marine animals, they've got nowhere else to go, you know. They live in the ocean and we have turned the ocean into a complete rubbish dumpster. We find most of our animals actually entangled in very small pieces of rubbish. And there's really no limit to your imagination what we find. They're plastic bags, Ziploc bags, clothing, hats, gaskets, anything you can possibly think of. And the animals, they swim around in the ocean. Some of them play with it, others don't get to see it. They simply get caught in the debris. And for most of them, it's a death trap.
Now, I remember a few years ago, I was doing some filming in Kenya, so on the other side of Africa. And I was astonished, yes, to see the places that the rubbish came from. We were filming down the coast and we would see water bottles that had washed in from India, from all the way up in the Middle East, from stuff that had come in from the UK. Are you seeing that? Where are you seeing this rubbish come from? How far afield is it?
Here in Namibia, we are actually quite lucky because we're on the west coast of Africa. If you look at the east coast, Kenya, Mozambique, everywhere there, you get all the rubbish that's coming from Southeast Asia. And that is absolutely horrifying. You can spend hours doing a beach cleanup there and you come back a few hours later and it's all back. So that's absolutely terrifying. And in our case, our currents are actually keeping our part of the ocean relatively clean. We've got the Benguela current here and also here in Namibia, but the that's very specific to Namibia. We are a desert country. We've got only two rivers that flow throughout the year. So we don't get much rubbish from inlands. Because in a lot of other countries, that is a major issue, that a lot of plastic comes in from rivers. So it's pollution that's created inlands and then it gets washed into the ocean.
Katia Dreyer talking to Joe Inwood. To Sierra Leone now, where one man has made history by becoming the country's first ever blind law graduate. It's a landmark achievement for Amadou Aboubakar. He's still got another year to go before he can officially practice, but he's taken time out to tell Umaru Fufana a bit about his journey towards the legal profession.
At the very beginning of it, I was not having even a phone and I was not even having a computer. So, but what I did, I was like coming to colleagues. So I meet with them. I made sure I have a talk with them. I asked them also how the course look like and what can they help me if they have any notes. So I actually implore them to assist me with reading. So while they be reading, I put on my local recorder. I record all their information, all their audio. So when I go home, I listen.
So you couldn't access textbooks in Braille?
Not at all. Even up to this point, I'm still battling with actually having Braille textbook on law. So yeah, it's still a very big challenge. If you have the means, support, you have the your money, you have the earning power, I'm sure. Perhaps even to access a computer, internet was very difficult. But now, the mere fact you have any support, when support is there, you can have a laptop, you can have an Android phone, you can go to the internet and then do your browsing. And that's what I got when I was in year three now. So I got my phone and my laptop. So it was like an easy ride.
When your head of department called out your name during the conferment of your degree, could you talk me through what went through your mind, how you felt emotionally?
I was about to cry, really. I was like, I saw the journey so far off that I couldn't really be able to finish. I couldn't achieve that. So, like, that very day when they called my name, I was like, oh, God, you are really very great. I was like, I've done it.
Amadou Aboubakar. And to hear a longer version of that conversation, just search for our sister BBC podcast, Africa Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come.
Some German people drink their beer after work and we just want to smoke our weed after work.
Germany relaxes its cannabis laws. A week after the killing of five Chinese engineers and their Pakistani driver, the authorities in Pakistan have made a dozen arrests. Officials said among those detained was the man suspected of facilitating the attack, which took place in the northern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. I heard more about the arrests and the original attack from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
A group of Chinese engineers, they were returning from the capital Islamabad to Dau Dam project site, where more than 1,000 Chinese workers are staying. And in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, when this van was crossing, a vehicle was coming in the opposite direction, and then suddenly there was an explosion, and there were videos circulating on social media showing this particular incident. And following this, this vehicle fell into a deep ravine. Five Chinese engineers and their Pakistani driver, they were killed. And China has expressed a strong concern over the security of its citizens based in Pakistan. As you know, China has invested billions of dollars and they are carrying out various infrastructure projects inside Pakistan. So there are Chinese nationals. And now the police say that they have arrested at least 12 people in connection with this incident, especially one of those persons who they say facilitated the movement of this explosives-laden vehicle into Pakistan.
Why were the Chinese engineers being targeted?
Attacks on Chinese nationals are not uncommon. Usually these things happen in the Balochistan province, far southwest of Pakistan, where China is also building a deep port and an economic complex in Gwadar area. And there they have been attacks because the Baloch separatist rebels, they accused the Chinese of exploiting their natural resources and also putting pressure on Pakistan. But what is happening in Northwest is different because the police suspect Pakistani Taliban could be responsible for this particular attack.
Anbarasan Etirajan.
President Erdogan's AK party has suffered its biggest ever defeat in local elections in Turkey, causing a political setback just a year after Mr. Erdogan secured a fifth term in office. The vote was also the largest victory in 45 years for the main opposition CHP party, which won in the five largest urban centres, including Turkey's biggest city, Istanbul. Supporters of the opposition celebrated late into the night.
We feel incredible. We are living a day that we have been waiting for years. We are so happy. We cannot believe it.
Democracy won. The Republic won. I'm so happy. I'm going to lose my mind.
We are in our early 20s. We really see this as a salvation.
We want to see a more free country where the economy is better. Turkey is way below its potential and we believe that it can show larger development.
Turkey's opposition leader Özgür Özel said the results showed that voters had decided to establish a new politics in Turkey. That was a theme picked up by the Secretary General of his party, Selin Sayak Buka, when she gave us her reaction to the results.
We're very excited. We're excited because we're at the start of a new era of politics. And we're excited because the good service that has been provided in our local governments in the past 5 years has actually now been extended to a much larger geography in Turkey. So we look forward to serving to a larger population and to ensuring that democracy, rule of law, and a strong welfare state is actually established through our local governments, which should open up a new era of politics in that way as well.
It was just last year that President Erdogan won the presidential election, and then this year he's obviously suffered this major reverse. What do you think has led to the change in his electoral fortunes over this last year?
I think two dynamics have played out. One has been people are really fed up of the polarization. So we have a very strong coming together under the umbrella of CHP this time. And the second is the economy has been doing so poorly that people are seeking out now ways where reaching out government resources, giving them to those who are in need in solidarity and infrastructure investments instead of the rentier system that Erdogan has built, has actually been approved through the very strong coming back of those cities that we were governing and indeed now into new cities who are saying we want the same service, we want the same understanding of politics.
One of the things that's been quite notable over the years of President Erdogan's time in power is the increasing role of Islam in politics, and it's something which obviously is the Turkish state always tried to avoid. Is that something that your party would try to reverse as you gain more power, to return Turkey to its secular roots?
What we seek to do is indeed end the polarization in Turkey and end the abuse of all values that make Turkey Turkey and all values people feel as their own values. These should not be abused by politicians. Instead, it should be allowed in a very free way to be lived by every individual in their own sense of being. So what we would want to end is the polarization and the abuse of ethnic identities, the abuse of religion as a political instrument, but rather make sure that the rule of law and our constitution, which protects the freedom of every individual to live their religion in the way they wish to make sure that they can live their ethnic identity the way they wish to, will be ensured through a very democratic and a new era of politics. So we seek to end the polarization and the abuse of all these values that make Turkey Turkey at the end of the day.
Selin Sayak Buka, she was speaking to Joe Inwood. From today, people in Germany will no longer be prosecuted for possessing small amounts of cannabis. The government says the part legalization is an attempt to tackle the black market. The new rules are a watered-down version of what was originally planned under the government's coalition agreement. The rules for medical marijuana are also being relaxed. Our correspondent Jessica Parker reports from Dresden.
Here, machen wir ohne Tipp?
A group of young men smoke cannabis in a park. Over 18s can now possess up to 25 grams of the drug in public, enough for dozens of joints, and grow up to three plants at home. This is Neustadt, the heart of Dresden's alternative scene, where we meet Marcel Ritschel.
Some German people drink their beer after work, and we just want to smoke our weed after work.
He wants to set up a newly allowed, not-for-profit cannabis social club.
Like a gardening club, but for hemp.
To grow and distribute the drug to members.
Every gram from cannabis, which goes from the Cannabis Social Club, is 1 gram that's not on the black market.
What do you say to people who say, look, cannabis is addictive and it is harmful, especially to young people?
Everything has dark sides, and you have to know about the dark sides, and only when it's not illegal you can freely talk about these dark sides.
Legalisierung weiterer Drogen den Konsum bei Kindern und Jugendlichen eindämmen werden. Das ist der größte Blödsinn, den ich je gehört habe, liebe Kolleginnen und Kollegen.
There was a stormy debate in Parliament over these changes, which are controversial and complex. The social clubs will be for German residents only to guard against cannabis tourism, but they can't open until July. Alexander Poitz from the German Police Union believes demand will outstrip legal supply.
Wir vermuten, dass der Schwarzmarkt gestärkt werden wird.
We assume that the black market will be strengthened, particularly at the beginning in the chaos phase, when demand will be great because of the signal this law sends. The black market and criminal networks will adapt, and they will also infiltrate the social clubs.
Just outside Dresden, I wash my hands and put on an overall. The building I'm in used to be a slaughterhouse. It's now being used to grow medical cannabis. I'm wearing rubber Crocs because you have to come in here for hygiene purposes. And just to describe the room I'm in, it's full of weed. There are heat lamps above me on the ceiling, about 650 cannabis plants in the room. They'll produce, we're told, between 80 to 100 kilograms of dried cannabis, and they're nearly ready to be harvested. That's probably going to happen in the next couple of weeks. The new rules mean facilities like this will be able to grow and sell more. Philip Goebel is a managing director of Demican.
Cannabis will not be a narcotic anymore in Germany. It will be just as any other pharmaceutical product, which makes it much more easier for patients to get it from a doctor and to get it from the pharmacy. So we think that the volume will double by end of the year, starting from the last year. We think it will take time for doctors and for patients to get used to it, to buy it in the pharmacy in the end.
An intricate water system feeds these plants. The benefits of medical cannabis are debated, while arguments around the relaxation of recreational use have dripped through German society for years. That'll likely continue. Conservatives have promised to reverse the changes if they get into power.
Jessica Parker. Ideas are bulletproof. The three words that now hang above the door of one of Hong Kong's most loved independent bookshops, which has been forced to close. Hundreds of well-wishers gathered to say their final goodbyes. Margaret Ng is a former pro-democracy politician. She says Mount Zero was a symbol of Hong Kong's fearless mindset.
It is a spirit, and that spirit is unvanquished. It does not disappear. It does not become depressed because of all this. Look at how cheerful people are. They are totally undaunted. In fact, the fact that they have survived this kind of oppressive behavior is something to celebrate.
Critics say a new security law imposed by China means freedom of expression in the territory is coming under further pressure. Our BBC Asia Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton has more details.
Mount Zero is actually just the latest independent bookstore that's closed in Hong Kong. I know of two others that have been forced to close in the past few months. Mount Zero closed for the same reasons that the others have closed. It was subject, its owners say, to increasing pressure from the authorities, almost weekly inspections by different branches of the Hong Kong government, some demanding to see their fire safety certificates, others demanding that they submit to food inspections, even though they're bookstores. And so it was kind of a constant litany of inspections, and basically the message from the authorities was that they were being watched. Mount Zero in particular was known for holding small events, and police began showing up with video cameras saying that they were monitoring what was going on. And so I think the owners of Mount Zero, who at one point were very media friendly and were always willing to talk, had recently gone underground, become much more quiet. They said in a social media post that they just simply couldn't put up with it anymore.
So what's the reaction been?
Well, it's a tricky one, Alex, because Hong Kong in general has been subject to an increasing number, really a massive security crackdown, dating back to 2020 when China imposed a national security law on Hong Kong following huge pro-democracy protests there. That first security law imposed by China really put a damper on freedom of expression in the city. And so under that shadow, we've seen these bookstore closures.
Hong Kong's special status gave it its status as an international business center. That's got to be under threat, hasn't it?
This new security law, we're seeing an instance in which taxi drivers are being encouraged to listen into conversations held by their passengers and to report anything suspicious that they hear. Christian priests have been told that if their parishioners come to them in a confession, they must report anything that they hear in confessions. And so this is a really dark time in Hong Kong, and I think foreign businesses are reflecting alarm at those changes.
Celia Hatton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Mazetska, and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts. The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.